coming up, talking about every single NBA playoff series with Tom Avestro. That's right now. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. We got a really loaded episode today talking about the NBA playoffs with Tom Avestro. What's up, Tom?
What's going on, Kev?
Good to have you back on the show after we missed last week. You just don't like the play-in. You hate the play-in, but you love the playoffs. Is that true, Tom?
I'm here for the playoffs. I do a really good Pitbull impression, and so playoffs, let's go.
Let's do it, Tom. Let's start off with the Nuggets and the Clippers because we saw that game on Thursday night. Nuggets won this one 117-83. I thought this would be the close game of the night. Instead, it was a blowout. Clippers win. Kawhi Leonard, James Harden, Norm Powell, Ivica Zubac all had between 19 and 21 points. They held the Nuggets below 50% from two, below 30% from three. And Tom, this series, they continue to do an absolutely outstanding job on Nikola Jokic. Jokic is shooting only 50% on post-ups, down from 58% during the season. And Zubac, man, they're not doubling. And he continues to do well. What are you seeing from Zubac in the series defending Nikola Jokic?
I remember earlier this year in the Blazers broadcast, Lamar Hurd asked me, is there anyone in the league that can slow down Nikola Jokic? Or at least, is there anyone who's kind of a Jokic defender that cannot stop him but slow him down? And I looked through the numbers, and the guy who defends him best one-on-one is Ivica Zubac. And you're seeing it in this series that they feel like they don't have to double every time like other teams do. They can guard him straight up. And Zubac is big enough, smart enough, and moves his feet well that he is just the quintessential Jokic defender. You're never going to lock him down. But in the half court in this series, the Denver Nuggets are scoring just 92 points per 100 possessions, according to Cleaning the Glass. That's down from their fourth best mark in the regular season of 104. And Jokic just doesn't have a lot of places to go. And Jamal Murray, usually he and Jokic can just make music in that two-man game, but they need other guys to step up. And so far in this series, Jokic hasn't been able to assert himself because Zubac is doing such a great job defending him. And look, the Denver Nuggets do not defend well enough if they can't score 120 points a game in the postseason. And with Zubac guarding and limiting Jokic in the way that he has with the strength, the smarts, and just great hands and feet, the Denver Nuggets don't have a chance. Their defense isn't good enough. And so without the offense being at a high level, they just cannot have a chance in this series.
So far this series, Zubac has defended Jokic 33 possessions on isolations and post-ups. And on those plays, Jokic and the Nuggets have scored only 19 points. And of those 33 plays, they've doubled just one time. So they're not doubling when it's Zubac versus Jokic. That came in game one. It was a play where Zubac had a closeout onto Jokic from three and Jokic drove, and then multiple Clippers converged on the play. That was the only time they doubled when Zubac was defending Jokic on a post-up or an isolation. Now, everybody else, they're doubling 26% of the time. That includes Ben Simmons, who's been really good. He's battling. He's trying to push Jokic off of his spots. And like, it's cool to see Ben Simmons kind of finding his lane there, but they're doubling a lot when it's in. They're doubling when it's Harden. And like I said, they've doubled once on 33 ISOs and post-ups when it's Zubac. And they've only scored 19 points on those. When it's everybody else, 27 points on 27 plays. That's not great for the Nuggets. Like 27 points on 27 plays when it's not Zubac, that's still below their season averages. Just to put it into perspective, during the regular season, when Jokic posted up or isolated, the Nuggets scored 976 points on 927 positions. So they were over a point per play. Clippers are playing them even when it's not even Zubac defending him, who's done an outstanding job in this series. And I just feel like if you're doing such a good job on Jokic, as you said, they did a great job during the regular season. They're doing a great job now, Tom. When you're doing that and you're not getting anything else from anybody else, the bench is 2 for 14 in the game. Russ was 1 of 5 from 3 in 9 minutes before he left with a left foot injury. MPJ, two of nine. He does not look like himself. He didn't look like himself even before the shoulder injury. He definitely didn't look like himself in that game too. And then you juxtapose that against the Clippers. Batum, 4 of 6 from three off the bench, 12 points, 5 boards, 3 blocks, 2 assists, connective playmaking, doing everything. Chris Dunn playing outstanding minutes again, everywhere on defense. Ben Simmons, who I mentioned, flying around defensively, battling hard against Jokic, making his typical connective passes, not scoring, but it doesn't matter when everybody else is getting buckets. Derek Jones, it's just a completely different supporting cast behind the stars for the Clippers versus what the Nuggets are getting. And I kind of regret picking this to be a 7-game series. Through 3 games now, I feel like it's going to get over a bit sooner. Do you feel the same?
Yeah, yeah. And you know what? This is kind of the Adam Mares theory, is that you fire Michael Malone because you're worried about them getting on a roll in the postseason, and then you have to kind of keep the guy. Whereas they fire Michael Malone and they have Adelman there where he's going to be the head coach, but it just seems like they don't have the bodies and they're getting exactly what they want, where they're completely getting outclassed, outplayed in this series. And it should be 3-0. Clippers. It very well could be 3-0 Clippers. And you're looking at a Denver Nuggets team that they're losing bodies. Michael Porter Jr. cannot raise his arms above his shoulders, and you're seeing him not being able to shoot the ball. And if you can't have Michael Porter Jr. shooting the ball or cutting hard to the rim and finishing at a high level, he's useless out there. And then Russell Westbrook, before the game, landing awkwardly on his foot on kind of like a D-cell practice, ends up basically hurting himself and limiting himself in the game. And then he's just like, I can't go anymore. Who else is out there for the Nuggets? And I do think that this is kind of what the Nuggets prescribed by firing Michael Malone, is like, they in a way, they wanted kind of the floor to fall out from underneath them because they could justify cleaning house and trying to figure out a total reset of the franchise and justifying, look, we fire Mike Malone just a handful of games before the postseason, and now we go into a full-out just retooling around Nikola Jokic, which they need. I don't know where you go, because Michael Porter Jr., his contract, Aaron Gordon, his contract, and you have a lot of deals that it's going to be tough to retool around Jokic, but this kind of collapse or this kind of performance, both ends of the floor, it necessitates a big shakeup. And I think if you're the Kroenkes, you're looking at this and saying, okay, at least we have a direction here. If the Clippers beat us in 5 games, look, we got to hit the reset button.
Yeah, I don't want to bury him completely yet just because of Jokic's greatness, but I've seen very, very little through 3 games to feel any sense of confidence that the Nuggets are going to be able to win this series. You mentioned the injuries, of course. We've talked about Jokic, how he's been contained. And like, it's just the basic fact, the Clippers have been dominant. They've been absolutely unbelievable for a month and a half now. They've won 20 out of 24 games going back to March 5th. Top net rating in the NBA over that stretch. They're 9-3 versus playoff teams over this stretch, including this series against Denver, for what it's worth. They're starting to feel like a 65-win caliber team disguised as a 50-win team. Like, that's what it feels like with the Clippers. And so, like, you know, that's where, like, with them, the series next round against Oklahoma City is just going to be remarkable, because they're not a 50-win team. They are. Like that's the way they're going to go down the record books. But the way this team closed the year with Kawhi Leonard at full health, James Harden ascending even more than he did earlier in the season when he was carrying the team, carrying a greater load than he would need to in his mid-30s, in these role players, the way things are clicking, the Clippers just feel like a 65-win team to me. And I regret picking it in 7. It's going to be over sooner than that.
I mean, I just felt like this was the story all season long with Denver, is that they can't defend a team like the Clippers that really struggled to score. Of course, differently with Kawhi Leonard out there, Norm Powell hitting shots like he did on Thursday night. But Denver's defense is getting exposed here, that they just don't have enough plus defenders to guard a team like the Clippers. And the Clippers, with Kawhi Leonard, with Nick Batum shooting this well, and Norm Powell shooting this well, Zubats playing as well as he has, this is a team in the way that Draymond Green describes that there's, you know, 82 game players and then 16 win players, in the sense that you need postseason players. You need guys that can win in the postseason when things get tough. The Clippers have a bunch of those guys and a head coach with Ty Lue and Jet Van Gundy. I loved hearing after the game, Kawhi Leonard talked about how important Jet Van Gundy was in getting them ready for this game. And so they've got two elite coaches, playoff tested coaches here, and Jet Van Gundy and Ty Lue, who are playing against an inexperienced coaching staff with Adelman, who, granted, great assistant coach, but he's talking after the game about how great the wall is and how important the home court advantage is for the Clippers. And it just seems like everywhere you look in this series, and we're dealing with the Clippers here, right, Kev? So we have to be careful about getting too far ahead of ourselves. But like, this looks like the Clippers are going to run away with this thing. And I love the wall. I love the energy in the building and all the histrionics that they were doing, the shenanigans with the horse head and all the chants that they were doing.
I love it.
It's great. And I got to say, this is what the NBA needs. We need more of this. We need more home court advantages and more like, I remember in Miami, the white hot, where they were all dressed in white for the playoff games. It felt like a totally different game. And when you see it with the Clippers, it's great that they've turned a negative in the fan base with the Clippers and always being in the shadow of the Lakers, turning it into a positive. And another game four here with them at home, this looks like it could get ugly quickly.
Yeah, it definitely could get ugly quickly. The wall is cool. The wall is great. The horse heads that they had there to distract Jokic were cute. It's a cute thing, you know. Like there's a lot of trash talk and a lot of negativity. It was just a cute form of trash talk and competitiveness between the two teams. I absolutely loved it. And the wall, statistically, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but statistically, shooters on that end of the floor, opponent shooters, are shooting a lower free throw percentage than they are any other situation. So it's working so far. So good for the Clippers. And like you said, we're not going to get too ahead of ourselves, but it's looking very good for them. Across town with the Lakers, they won their game two game over the Timberwolves after losing game one. Lakers lost game one, 117-95 against the Wolves. Came back and won game two, 94-85 over Minnesota. I felt like the main thing in that game was Luka just looked a lot more comfortable against Minnesota's length, Minnesota's switching. He was looking for the pass more. And also on the other end of the floor, they're blitzing Ant a little bit more. That was something I wondered about entering the series. Would we see the Lakers divert away from what they did all season? They did not blitz pick and rolls very much at all this season. They were near the bottom in the NBA in blitz frequency. Game one, they blitzed Ant on 1 out of 25 pick and rolls. And game two, they blitzed 5 out of 23 pick and rolls. So not a large sample necessarily, but it felt like they upticked the aggression against Edwards when they were defending him. And then also Luka specifically looked a hell of a lot more comfortable creating his own shot and playmaking in game two against Minnesota's defense.
I got to say, I feel pretty good about the Minnesota Timberwolves. This is a team that had the exact same effective field goal percentage expected. Like their shot quality in that game too was exactly the same as the Lakers. The big difference was they just weren't hitting those shots. They got a ton of open shots. They were abysmal hitting those open looks from downtown. And it seemed like, man, the good process was not being met by good results. And if I'm the Minnesota Timberwolves, I'm looking at this game three and feeling pretty good about ourselves heading back home with a lot of good process, and they weren't able to hit the shots. And a lot of this momentum or quote-unquote adjustments that need to be made is just whether you can hit the open shots. And in game one, they hit everything. In game two, they couldn't hit the broadside of a barn. And I think we shouldn't overestimate the ability for the Minnesota Timberwolves to come back and hit those shots and try to get some momentum here in game three, where I think we're kind of looking at the 84 points that they scored. And I think part of this is we're retroactively looking back and saying, okay, what didn't go right for the Timberwolves? I think offensively they're okay. And if some of those shots fall, this is a totally different game. And I expect, you know, Anthony Edwards, who's only had, I think, 6 free throw attempts in this series in 2 games, a guy who was getting 20 free throw attempts in a game, oftentimes in this regular season, I think we're going to see the big breakout game from Anthony Edwards here. And he's always got this kind of energy about him that he's great under the bright lights and he loves the attention. And I feel like coming back at home, we're going to see a breakout game.
Yeah, I mean, game one, he had 22 points on 22 shots. Game two, he had 25 points on 22 shots. So he has not had that game that you're talking about yet. 9 assists in game one, only 0 assists in game two. And that, to your point, sometimes it is simple. Do they make a lot of shots? Do they miss a lot of shots? In Minnesota game one, McDaniels is going off. Naz Reid had 6 three-pointers in game one. This is an absurd amount. He only had 3 attempts in game two. It's a massive
but
difference.
It was Jamie Daniels and Julius Randle. Like those two guys, when they're hitting 9 threes, I mean, that's a total game changer. So there's a happy medium between what they showed in game two and what they showed in game one. And I think Minnesota is going to be much better from that standpoint of just knocking down those open opportunities in game two.
One thing you had in your post that we showed on screen that's interesting with Luka's usage in these two games, and game two specifically, but LeBron only ran 7 pick and rolls in game two, down from 19 in game one. So Luka's going to be the primary creator for this team, obviously. But I do think for the Lakers, it's a bit surprising that Luka's posting his highest usage percentage ever, at least compared to last postseason with Dallas. With this team, with LeBron James and Austin Reeves, you would think that the Lakers are going to be able to find a better balance in game three moving forward, but so far they have yet to be able to. LeBron and Reeves have not been able to create offense in the way that Luka has so far. But why do you think that is with Minnesota's defense? Is it purely the length? Is it the switching that's bothering them?
I think honestly, LeBron is still, I think, limited by that groin injury. I don't think he looks 100%. And remember that Austin Reeves lob where everyone was joking on X about how Austin Reeves is throwing it to the 2019 LeBron. And LeBron just caught it. Was funny. Like, yeah, I'm just going to lay this in, right? But that, I think, is symbolic of what I think LeBron James is playing through, is that normally if he was 100%, he would be leaping up and at least trying to convert that dunk. But you look at the numbers in the 2020 postseason run, LeBron averaged 8 minutes of ball possession per game. 8 minutes. Right now, in these two games, it's 4.1. It's cut in half. So that's with Anthony Davis. That's with another co-star. And he's, yes, not Luka Doncic, not a guy who's going to run your offense for you in AD. But this is a totally different LeBron. With a star player, he is taking a back seat. And it's interesting to me that we're going to watch LeBron James with some really good box score numbers, but the way that they're using him in this series, a lot of times in the crunch time, they were just throwing LeBron in the corner and letting Luka cook. And that's just not how LeBron James has won titles before. And this is what we look like, you know, LeBron James at age, at over 40 years old, playing his 22nd season, this is kind of what we envisioned, is him taking kind of a secondary role offensively. But we need to see more from Austin Reeves. And it is interesting that his time of possession, LeBron, has fallen in almost by 25% even last year. And it's cut in half since that 2020 run.
Rockets and the Warriors will be playing game three on Saturday night. Sometimes it feels like the playoffs are last forever. Game two was way back on Wednesday with the Warriors losing that game to Houston 109-94 after winning game one 95-85. Houston's defense through two games has been consistently great. 95 points and 94 points holding the Warriors to that. Game two, of course, was a bit different though, because we saw Jimmy Butler get hurt in that first half, unfortunately. But it seems like we got some good news that he had a best case scenario result here. He does not suffer an injury that's going to keep him out long term. He's questionable for game three. So for the Warriors, you have to be feeling a bit better there. Well, did you see his quote, Tom? Or not his quote, but Bernie Lee, his agent, said through somebody in media, he's like, pray for the bear. I guess it's an old Kobe quote. Pray for the bear. In other words, Jimmy Butler is going to defeat that bear. That's what Bernie Lee is saying. So you have to feel good if you're a Warriors fan seeing that.
Yeah, man, that was brutal to watch. And
yeah, it was.
I think Jeff Stotts over at InStreetClothes.com has noted that this team has a lot of those glute muscle contusions or tailbone injuries. Kuminga had one. Stephen Curry's been dealing with it all season long. And in the past, he's had this. And Jimmy Butler now has it. It's just this weird coincidence that the Warriors continue to have this injury that haunts them. And with Jimmy Butler, I don't think it was a dirty play by Amen Thompson. I think he got tangled up and kind of pushed a little bit where he got tangled up with Draymond, and it happened under the basket where unfortunately he clipped Jimmy Butler. But it does kind of open the door into this larger conversation. The Houston Rockets are beating up the Warriors. I don't think it's legal. Like, a lot of this is they're doing things off the ball with Steph Curry and fighting through screens and just bulldozing the Warriors in ways that, like, I don't think is being litigated correctly. Like, I think the refs are letting the Rockets get away with a lot of physicality. And I think, like, that one play was not a dirty play, but it is emblematic of, like, the Warriors are having to deal with a lot of physicality from the Houston Rockets side that was not on purpose, I want to stress. But this is an Ime Udoka series. Like, they are absolutely manhandling the Warriors on and off the ball. And I wonder how this game is going to be officiated. Now that we've seen Jason Tatum get hurt, we've seen Jimmy Butler get hurt, and Ja Morant get hurt in these acrobatic plays, I'm wondering if we're going to see, Kev, these game threes, or as we get deeper into the postseason, that the referees are going to try to manage this and contain this a little more. We're seeing a lot more scuffles across the league in the postseason and a lot more fouls and physicality. I think this is the cost of physicality. You're seeing a lot of these guys who are going up at the rim and they're getting hit hard, and the Jimmy Butler one aside, I think we're going to see the referees are trying to rein this in a little bit more. And especially in this Houston series, the officials and the whistle is going to matter more in this series than any other series in the NBA.
I do think it's going to matter more in this series than any other time. That's spot on. And look, I have a lot of Warriors fans in my life who are sending me clips and in our group chats and all that, talking about the physicality in this series. And like, look, it's true. Like, they're allowing a lot of grabbing, a lot of touching, a lot of pushing. It's just the reality of it. Personally, I'm okay with a lot of the physicality. For years, we've had defenses that have been allowed to be physical on the interior, not allowed to be physical on the perimeter. We're seeing glimpses of what this might look like, where Stephen Curry isn't getting all the whistles. He's never been a high whistle player, but these are things that would typically be whistled over the course of time on the perimeter. Like, when he's getting grabbed, that three-pointer he hit, like, that should have been a foul. The broadcasting crew calls it out. Official standing right there doesn't see it. It's kind of remarkable. And never mind, Dylan Brooks on a play got kind of fell on a three, trips Draymond. I thought that was the dirtiest play so far of the series. Amen Thompson play.
There's no history there. Dylan Brooks never, you know, gets his feet tangled up or has any dirty plays. Never. It never happens with that guy.
He's like, an angel. He'd never do that.
I think Stephen Curry, because of his size and the way he shoots, for some reason, I don't think he gets the three-shot fouls that James Harden or others, or Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, other guys get. And I think something needs to be done about it. Is like, We're it's not that we need to protect Stephen Curry because he's Stephen Curry, but he gets hit on those three-pointers way more because of his ability to move while shooting, and that kind of that movement and that instability as he's in his shooting form creates a lot of contact with the defender. And he flops a lot. Like, he gets hit on the arm and then his legs get dropped out from underneath him. Like, I get it. Sometimes Steph overdoes it. But I think if you look at the numbers, James Harden and other players get way more three-shot fouls than Stephen Curry. And you can't watch the game and not say that Stephen Curry is not getting hit on some of these plays. And Fred VanVleet's getting away with, I mean, he's just like pulling at him in those screens and when he goes up for a shot, way more contact than should be allowed. And I suspect we're going to see a different whistle.
I do want to talk about pure basketball here, though, too, because the difference between game one and game two for Jalen Green, to me, I think was symbolic of what this Houston team is missing. When you talk about they have the defenders, they have a bunch of role players, they don't have that star bucket getter. Jalen Green was a star bucket getter in game two. He had 38 points on 13 of 25 from the field, 8 of 18 from 3, got into his pull-up, was hitting shots off the catch. He was getting anywhere he wanted in the lane as well. The creation was there from him as a passer, 6 assists to only 2 turnovers. Jalen Green, he has had these stretches throughout his career where he just gets hot for 3 weeks and he averages 30 points on elite efficiency, and there's nothing defenses can do to stop him, and Rockets fans feel like they have this star. And then sometimes he goes through stretches where he looks lost out there. For Golden State, I didn't find that they had any answers for this guy on Houston. And for the Rockets, Şengün's their best player, Van Vliet's their veteran, Amen Thompson and Dylan Brooks are their best defenders, but Jalen Green might actually be indeed the true X factor of the series. Because if you're right, Tom, if they're going to officiate this series more tightly and Warriors start getting more calls and some of that, you know, those grabs and pulls start getting called for Houston and guys fall into even more foul trouble than they did in game 2 with 4 fouls for Brooks and Şengün and Thompson, Jalen Green's going to have to be the guy who has more big games like this. That was my main takeaway from Houston after that game 2 was they need Jalen Green to have another game or 2 like this to win the series.
Yeah, and it's all because their offense really struggles to, you know, float when they don't have Jalen Green getting hot. And he had 4 straight single-digit scoring games heading into this one. 4 straight. Can he please be consistent? This is a young player, I get it, but when you're trying to win a championship, you need more consistency than you need some of the highs and the lows. The fact that we're having so much volatility with Jalen Green has got to be maddening for Ime Udoka and the fan base. It's just we don't know what Jalen Green we're going to get on a nightly basis. And he was really struggling coming into this game too. And you look at, he had 21 points in his previous 4 games combined going into this game. So they need Jalen Green to be a lot more consistent. And I'm not saying that like you save some of those makes in game 2 for the rest of the series, but just can we get 25? Like just get a consistent 25 from Jalen Green rather than just Jekyll and Hyde every single time with the Houston Rockets. They need more consistency out of him. It was a great performance, don't get me wrong, but we need more consistency out of that guy, and he's young. So it's going to take a while for him to get his playoff legs, but they absolutely need A-plus Jalen Green if they're going to win this series.
You know, Butler goes out after 8 minutes, and then Steve Kerr is just throwing darts. Pat Spencer plays 12 minutes, and he played pretty well. He played pretty good. Jonathan Kuminga did not. 26 minutes, 4 of 12 from the field. A lot of poor decisions out there for Kuminga. I thought Kerr looked justified with his decision to bench Kuminga. It's also unfair to expect Kuminga to come out there after, you know, multiple weeks of not playing and to go into a playoff game against a physical Houston opponent and succeed. But I did think in that game too, you know, if Pod's dealing with a stomach issue, Kuminga needing to play, Pat Spencer needing to play, it did also put into perspective if Butler is at all limited the remainder of the series, if he is not capable of some of those playoff Jimmy performances, even if the officiating changes in the series, Tom, it's hard to feel good about Golden State. That Houston just has more options out there that can be relied on, because this Golden State roster behind Jimmy, behind Steph, just there's not much out there that can be relied on a night-to-night basis. Houston has more guys that can go off and get a bucket.
The series is over, period, if Jimmy Butler is limited. Like, that's it. Like, the series is over because they need someone to carry the offense and get the actions, getting downhill, getting to the rim, getting to the free throw line, defending on the other end. If Jimmy Butler is limited, if he's 50% and the Bear wins, okay, we're praying for Jimmy Butler now. That's it. The Warriors just don't have enough bodies that can play at a high level on both ends of the floor. Those two-way guys, they just don't have that on this roster. And it's a big reason why with Jimmy Butler, Draymond Green, and Steph Curry in the lineup, there's something like 26-5 this season. And otherwise, they're a middling team. So Steph Curry needs someone that can be an innings eater offensively. And that's Jimmy Butler attacking the rim, getting downhill, playing big on both ends of the floor. They just don't have anyone that approximates that in the least bit. And Kuminga had his big opportunity. This was the big spot, and he blew it. He blew it. And I would be surprised if Jimmy Butler comes back that we see Kuminga playing any significant minutes going forward, because I feel like Steve Kerr kind of was like, all right, you've been praying for minutes and begging for minutes and a bigger role. And he kind of fell flat in game two. And I think that was his big opportunity. He lost it.
It's unfortunate. You know, I thought Kuminga had a chance to be good in his NBA career. And maybe he still does. He's still young, but it doesn't seem like it's going to happen at Golden State. Let's talk about some Eastern Conference series, Tom, because on Thursday night we saw what was the best game of the night. Knicks beat the Pistons in game three, 118 to 116. A great crowd for Detroit. You know, congrats to them getting a home playoff game. Unbelievable game. Unfortunately, it ended in a loss. I felt like the final 2 minutes of this game, I think it was maybe a minute 40 left, the key play in the game. The Pistons are down 3 points. Cunningham has the ball on the right wing, spin cycles OG Anunoby, breaks his ankles. And in that moment, you pause, and I'm thinking to myself, like, wow, Cade's going to score for sure. They're about to cut this lead to one right now, or maybe he gets an and one. And then Karl Anthony Towns rotates over, jumps straight in the air. Just Cade gets no lift on his one-footed layup attempt. The ball kind of falls out of his hands, and Jalen Brunson races down the end of the floor, scores through Tim Hardaway's contest. Knicks turn out what could have been a one-point game into a five-point game with a minute 20 or so left. That little sequence there, unfortunately, I feel is where the game was lost for Detroit. And a lot of Pistons fans, I posted the clip on social, and a lot of Pistons fans were like, you're crazy calling this amazing help defense from Cat. You're nuts. I thought it was good help defense.
Dude, it was just awesome. Looked a little awkward. Awesome.
It's great. It was perfectly timed, Tom. He came over and just immediately jumped straight up in the air, arms straight up. Cade should have leapt off of 2 feet. I felt like Cade was shocked that Cat was there. It's like he made it's a million dollar move, 10 cent finish is what it was for
Left
Cade
Cunningham. OG in the dust. Yeah.
Oh my God. It was a beautiful move. And Cat made a great play, which really was, you know, the cherry on top of a tremendous two-way performance for him. And then on the other end, Jalen Brunson faced the same type of contact from Tim Hardaway, who made a great attempt on Jalen Brunson, and Brunson scored through it, also did not get a foul. But for Cade, you know, he's had a really, you know, game one was not great for him. Game two was great. Game three is only 10 of 25 from the floor. The at-rim finishing is kind of the final piece, I feel like, with Cade. And I thought that was put on display there with that finish against Karl Anthony Towns, where Cade's got to find a way to finish that.
I didn't see your post on X, and I have it in my notes. 124 mark, game turns around here. Cade spin, Cat block, Brunson layup, a 0 point. I'm even saying that could have been a finish through Cat, maybe get an and one in the best case scenario. And then it's a 5 point swing on the other way, where it's you almost had a tie game there. A 3 point game could have been a tie game. And then on the other way, Jalen Brunson, a great finish at the rim the other way. That was to me the turning point in the game. We can talk about the weird officiating or the weird clock at the end of the game, but to me, that was the moment. That was the Pistons moment where it was like, oh, they might win this thing when he gets downhill going at the rim. And Cat, he had a couple really nice rim protective moments in the closing minutes of this game. And this is what you're asking for, is that in these big moments, can Karl Anthony Towns summon his rim protector, the Kentucky, back in his days at Kentucky, where he's able to play as a big, strong five? Rudy Gobert is no longer there to bail you out. Can you play above the rim? And I thought that was an excellent, excellent two-way play from Karl Anthony Towns down the stretch. Big plays from Cat, and that's what you want to see if you're a Knicks fan. But can we talk about the weird end of game?
Like, oh, well, one second. Before we get to that, I want to stay on Cat for a second, because Cat, through the first two games of the series, he's got Tobias Harris defending him. Harris, and he's doing nothing. Game three, he comes out, 31 points, 18 shots. Knicks are looking for him. And I think every Knicks fan in my life, this is what they wanted. It's like, why are we just not finding Cat here? Why are we not forcing and funneling the ball to him? I felt like they did a way better job at that in game three. And, you know, I know Wolves fans, you know, in the past would say, well, you know, Cat needs to find it himself. This happened there. It happens. It's going to happen everywhere with him. But sometimes, like, it's just about the structure and your objectives heading into a game. And I felt like New York found the right offensive balance in this game. Even Bridges, 13 shots, OG, 17 shots, Jalen Brunson, only 9 of 20 in the game. It just felt like a good offensive balance for the Knicks in that game that impressed me. Whereas with Detroit, you know, you're like, they need more out of Malik Beasley off the bench. He's yep. been very poor in games two and game three. He was 1 of 8 from three in game two, 2 of 10 from three in game three. Beasley, you know, he did not win Sixth Man of the Year. Peyton Pritchard did. But the argument for Beasley was, this guy is pivotal to the success of the Detroit Pistons. And if he has more 2 for 10 games, like it's hard to feel any good about Detroit's chances in the series. But yes, New York's offensive balance really stood out to me. Tom, what were you going to say about the officiating at the end of the game?
Well, yeah, before we get to that, I guess I also wanted to say, watch out for OG's shoulder. Like, at the end of that game, he was hunched over after one of the plays, and just it looked like he had a shoulder issue again, where he was basically his arm was completely limp at the end. And then he slowly runs back on defense. And I'm wondering if we're going to see that in game four, is any sort of wrap or any sort of limitations from OG and that shoulder that seems to be bothering him. And I will say this, like, the decision by the Pistons to go with Dennis Schroeder guarding Jalen Brunson down the stretch, I just think you want more size going at Jalen Brunson. He got too many open looks, and Schroeder, he competes, but he's just not big enough and smart enough defensively to stay with Jalen Brunson. And they got Asar Thompson right there. And I know Asar's had his issues in this series defending Jalen and a lot of the fouls that he's had, but I really think that down the stretch, I would have liked to have seen someone a little bit better than Schroeder guarding Jalen Brunson, because he was cooking.
Schroeder was getting buckets on the other end. Like, it's a tough balance. It's a really tough balance for JB Bickerstaff there, because Schroeder was making some plays and also giving up plays, even on the, like you said, the final weird inbound play after the free throw. The clock starts too soon, the Pistons are able to inbound. Like, who else was JB Bickerstaff supposed to have inbound the ball? Jalen Duren was on the floor. Cade Cunningham was on the floor. It was Beasley and Harris and Hardaway. You're not going to have any of those three as the inbounder on a critical play. Duren's your second best passer on the floor, and you weren't allowed to substitute on that play. You're not going to have Cade inbound, I don't think.
You have Cade.
Don't you want Cade with an opportunity to be a guy who might receive the ball and score?
No, 0.5 seconds left. You have the best alley-oop duo in the NBA, Kev. It's Cade Cunningham and Jalen Duren.
Full court alley-oop.
0.5 seconds.
It's unrealistic.
Oh, what was realistic was a throw in the backcourt to Cade Cunningham on the move that he's got to hit a 70-footer. No!
I know.
Cade Cunningham, who's taller than everybody, and throw an alley-oop at the rim. I have no idea. Why is Jalen Duren throwing in the inbound pass to Cade Cunningham on the move 70 feet away from the basket? It was insanity. Of course it didn't work.
Can we agree he was the second best option?
Oh, but whatever. The first best option is the one you go with, is the best alley-oop passer in the NBA going, connecting with Jalen Duren, who's a monster around the rim. I understand if it was like 3 seconds left. There was 0.5 seconds left. You didn't have time to gather and shoot. Just go and throw a bomb. Throw a touchdown pass over to Duren and have him leap over Karl Anthony Towns or Mitch Robinson, whatever it is, that gives you the best play. It made no sense to me why you have, yes, maybe the second best passing option, but that's honestly an indictment over the playmakers on the Detroit side. Like, when Duren is your best option to take the ball out in that situation, I disagree with that notion. I thought it was a big, big mistake there. But shout out to the scorekeeper, the timekeeper for the Detroit Pistons.
I know.
Starting the clock when Jalen Brunson shoots the ball, and then the refs are like, I mean, I guess they had an imminent possession, so you know what? We'll let the Pistons get it there. That was brilliant by the scorekeeper.
I haven't gone back and watched the game yet, but it made me wonder, wait a minute, on every missed free throw of this game, was the clock starting when it hit? Well, did this happen all game?
I got to imagine it didn't, but this is one of those things where you're just like, man. And Carl Anthony Towns called it out after the game. He's like, shout out to the score. I haven't seen that in my 10 years in the league, that a scorekeeper starts the clock as soon as it hits the rim. And everybody's like, what just happened?
It's a crazy moment. Game 4 will be on Sunday. On tonight, we have a Game 3 between the Bucks and the Pacers. Pacers are up 2-0 in this series, and they're just completely handling the Bucks. The Pacers look like a team. They know exactly who they are. They know their strengths and weaknesses. They know their opponent's strengths and weaknesses. They know how to exploit those. They know exactly what the plan is. They feel like a team that has an identity, whereas the Bucks just searching for answers. Defensively, especially, they tried zone in both of these games. They're giving up 1.14 points per play, according to Synergy. Drop with Brook Lopez isn't working. Switching isn't working. Doc Rivers is saying after the game he's not changing the starting lineup, which is crazy to me when the best lineups around Giannis the whole year have been with the bench guys. AJ Green plays only 12 minutes in Game 2. Kevin Porter Jr. plays only 15 minutes when he's played really well as of late. I just feel Doc has been completely pantsed by Rick Carlisle as a coach. Yep. In this performance, and the players on the Pacers, I picked the Bucks to win the series in 7. I regret doing that. I picked them because I thought Giannis was playing this just elite, best player in the world level basketball, and I'm picking the best player in the series, but the Pacers are the better team, period. End of story. I have very little hope for the Bucks in this series, and I predict in a week from now we're going to be talking about what does this mean for the Bucks offseason. But in this series specifically, what have you seen that's been so impressive from the Pacers, Tom, and or what's been so disappointing from the Bucks?
I mean, they're playing Brook Lopez off the floor. The guy has had zero impact at the rim. Defensively, with Giannis and Brook Lopez on the floor, the Milwaukee Bucks are allowing 139 points every 100 possessions. 139. That's basically like an open fast break every time down the floor in terms of efficiency. Like, that's insane. And that's for 37 minutes in this series. They've had that two-man lineup, or at least that two big lineup on the floor. And Doc Rivers, as you said, he's getting pants out there. Like, can you play AJ Green? Can you play him so you can get some sort of floor spacing and some sort of shot finishing from the perimeter, where Giannis, he's got to play at the five. They got to switch this up. And Doc Rivers, like, I've been kind of a Doc Rivers apologist with the three blown 3-1 leads historically. And I kind of think that that's overblown, because he got to win those three games in order to be embarrassed
come
like that.
Come on, Tom.
I swear to you,
Doc Rivers payroll? Like, that's what he says.
Check the record, dude. I checked the record on this. Like, I have said this, and now I feel really dumb about it. But it used to be that people would think that it's better to be swept than to blow a 3-1 lead. Like, I'm vehemently against that. Like, the idea that the way fans talk about, I'm not even going to do this rant anymore. But the point is, Doc Rivers is getting embarrassed in this series, and they.
Yes.
Part of me says
that we can agree on. Yeah.
But seriously, fans would rather you get swept than losing a 3-1 series lead. That's insane to me. All right. Anyway, Kev, this series looks like Brook Lopez is aged, that he can't stay with the Indiana Pacers, and the up-tempo and the rim protection has not been there. And I think this goes to just the Indiana Pacers are playing harder, and it might be a reflection of just this organization with the Chris Middleton trade. Everything that has happened with the blood clot from Damian Lillard bringing him back, I just think this is a lost season. It's a lost season for the Bucks. I picked the Indiana Pacers in this series, and it might be a lot sooner than we expected. And Damian Lillard did as much as he could with zero run up, zero ramp up in that recovery from his blood clot. I just don't think that the Milwaukee Bucks have enough. I'm surprised that they made an extension to Horace, the GM, already in the middle of this series, announced that they're going to extend their GM in this series, because I feel like there's a real sweep potential here.
Yeah, I think there's a real sweep potential too. Horace getting the extension now just like right now, right now. It's just very strange to me why they made this decision right now to extend Horace after all the missed draft picks. Like, I might just be about wanting a little bit of continuity. Maybe they trust him as the man, as the person, rather than some of the decisions that have been made. You know, that might be part of it. Like, from what I understand, Horst, like a lot of people do like John Horst, but the decisions have not been positive in the draft. He's had whiff after whiff after whiff after whiff. And granted, a lot of those are late first round picks. Those are hard picks to hit on. You got to hit. Sometimes you got to hit on them. And when you don't hit, that's what forces you to make some tough trades and lose future picks and deplete your asset cupboard. And that's what I feel like the position that they're in right now, where, you know, like, we'll see, you know, we'll talk about future Buck stuff next week, but Yana should take a really strong evaluation here and say, is this really where I want to be?
That's where I think this is all about. I think that's what this extension is all about, is I think the ownership looked at John Horst and the trust that Giannis has with him and that relationship, and feel like if Giannis is backing this guy and if Giannis wants this guy to be the GM going forward, it doesn't matter if the transactions haven't been great. The whole goal is to keep Giannis happy. And if Horst does that for this organization, that's why you make that contract extension. I just don't understand doing this in the middle of the playoff series when you're getting embarrassed out on the floor. Maybe wait till the offseason. But this, to me, was very confusing, the way that they announced this, or at least came to a deal at the end of the regular season. I'm not saying John Horst is a bad dude or anything like that. I'm saying just transactionally, you look at the deals that have been gone.
What you're saying is he's not a bad dude, but he's a bad GM. That's what you're saying.
after the title, I will say after the title, there are not many positive moves on his ledger. If you're going to say that he is the GM and he is responsible for the decision making and the roster and the player personnel, you can't argue that this has been a better alternative. And yes, there have been injuries with Chris Middleton and Giannis, but I really question the Kyle Kuzma trade. And that's a lot of assets that you're giving up around the championship core. And yes, we can say, dude put together a championship roster, but we can also say he deconstructed a championship roster too. And so both of those things can be true. And I'm surprised that they announced this in middle of the series, where Giannis is still great, but no one around him is playing nearly championship caliber. And Kyle Kuzma, I just don't get it. People have been backing terrible. Kyle Kuzma. I don't understand it. That was a crazy decision to acquire that guy to be your third piece. And I get it. Chris Middleton didn't look great, but I would rather have Chris Middleton on this team, even if he is 70%, and even if he can't be depended on going forward. The Kyle Kuzma trade just feels like a big swing and a miss.
You know, I wonder how much of this between Horst and Doc Rivers and the roster is just this lack of connectivity with the plan, because you get Kuzma. I would expect you would have seen lineups with Giannis at the five. Giannis at the five has not been out there in the postseason. It was barely out there at all during the regular season, even despite Bobby Portis being out. And I wonder if Horst made that move with the expectation that we'd see some of that, and Doc Rivers just hasn't done it, because Doc is stubborn. He likes to stick with his guns and do what works for him. We'll see if he changes the starting lineup before game three tonight, but he says he's not going to. We'll see. Through games, you mentioned it earlier, Tom, horrible defensive rating with Brook Giannis front courts out there. They have a minus 32 net rating in the minutes with Giannis and Brook out there together. They have an even net rating in the 40 minutes when it's Bobby Portis and Giannis Antetokounmpo. Even. Like, they have not
Earth
been
to Doc.
Bad.
Earth to Doc. Yes. Like, hello.
Come on. It's not a Brook Lopez series. You're going to get swept. It's not a Brook series. It's not a Brook series. It's a Bobby Portis series. And maybe also it's a Giannis at the five series with Kyle Kuzma at the four and shooters flanking them. Maybe that's what it is. And we have not seen it at all through two games. We barely saw it all season long, even though this is what I thought we would see when they got Kyle Kuzma, because it would give them that ability to have another big forward, versatile, switchable guy next to Giannis in the front court. We didn't see it. And, you know, like, it's crazy. Like, this week, this week was the 08 Celtics episode of Celtic City. Did you watch that, Tom? Did you watch the series at all? Well, so it's the 08 Celtics episode, and Doc Rivers is heavily featured in that one. So you get to see Doc from when he was hired as head coach. The Celtics targeted him. They wanted Doc. Danny Ainge wanted him. You see him through the early Pierce era with the bandage around his face in the Pacers series. You see all that. And then you see the way he built that culture with the 08 Celtics team and how the players really credit him for getting them to buy in together. That Doc Rivers does not exist anymore. He is not the head coach of the Milwaukee Bucks. That is a different Doc Rivers. And seeing that guy on screen there, the level of buy-in and investment, he had a quote in the doc where he's like, no pun intended, where he says, you know, throughout, you know, my life, you know, I used to go to bed, my dream is to be in the NBA. My dream is to be an all-star. My dream is to win a championship. And he's like, I finished my playing career, and the one dream left was to win a championship. And he's like, I still said that to myself before going to bed every night. And I wonder, when he won that championship, is that it? Like, did he just stop putting in the same level of care and effort that I felt that he did with some of those early Celtics teams? I know he got a lot of criticism, especially from Bill Simmons back in the mid-2000s in the Page 2 era, but I like Doc personally in the mid-2000s. I like Doc in 08, but I felt like in the early 2010s and then with the Clippers and then with the Sixers and now with the Bucks, it's just been the same old story over and over and over, and I don't feel like he's that same guy he was pre-title.
He was begging ownership not to hire him. He was telling the Milwaukee Bucks,
he wanted to go.
When Doc Rivers is telling you, please don't hire me, I don't know why you're doing it. Like, doing this publicly, he made a public campaign to convince the ownership not to hire him away from ESPN, and they still hired him. Maybe that was a sign that this might not work out. Yeah. And he hasn't done the things. Like, this is when getting Doc Rivers is supposed to come through, is in the postseason. You get these guys to rally and get them to play hard. You hold them accountable. You play lockdown defense, and none of that is happening. It's a big game 3 coming up for this, not just Doc Rivers, but I think this whole entire organization. We're on the doorstep of a sweep if the Milwaukee Bucks do not come out big in game 3.
Yeah, they have to win game 3. Let's talk about some of the other series and check in on those, starting off with a game we saw on Thursday night, OKC and Memphis. This was a game everybody, including me, is saying, how's this the game on TNT? How's this the game that's not on NBA TV? Well, the Nuggets get blown out by the Clippers. And then in this game, Memphis is blowing out the Thunder in the first half. They're up 29 points in the first half. They're up 27 points. Ja Morant and Scottie Pippen on a fast break. Lou Dort chases down Scottie Pippen, a great effort play, but then he turns awkwardly, reaches his arms as he's kind of slipping, and Ja's midair gets undercut by Lou Dort. And this isn't the first time Lou Dort's been around guys when they've gotten hurt. Do you think this was a dirty play by Lou Dort on Ja Morant, Tom?
No. No, not at all.
I don't either.
You can see his foot. He did not plant his foot well, lost his balance, and that's what happened. Like, this was not a dirty
play. We agree on this one. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think it was. I think it was just a great effort play and then an awkward. You can argue it was a little bit reckless to try to contest the shot, but he just stopped one guy. He was trying to stop the second guy. I think it's just an unfortunate situation that Ja is going for a monster dunk to extend the lead even more. And yeah, it just sucks. It sucks he got hurt. But I don't think it was dirty.
Am I allowed to say this? Scottie Pippen should have laid it in. He should have laid it in.
Yeah. Yeah, he should have.
Like,
he really should have.
I mean, I know this is playing the result a little bit, but like, Scottie Pippen Jr. had an awesome, awesome, awesome game, especially in that first half. But in that fast break, like, he should have just rose up and laid it in or dunk it or whatever it is to not give up the ball there. And I know you can fire up the crowd with a Ja Morant dunk. And like, that's what the fans want to see.
That's what it was, Tom. They wanted a highlight. They wanted a pile on. That's what it was.
And unfortunately, like the Ja Morant decision earlier this season where he's like, I'm not dunking anymore. This is why.
Should have stopped.
This is why. Is the idea of him at that size and the way that he flies through the air, a lot of times he's leaving himself vulnerable for a Lou Dort losing his balance and knocking his feet out from underneath him, and then he lands on his hip like that. Like, this is, unfortunately, the blessing and a curse when it comes to Ja Morant or Derrick Rose or Russell Westbrook. Is the very thing that we love about these guys is these 6'3", 6'4" guys that fly through the air with such power and such amazing acrobatics. This is the really tough part about it, is unfortunately they do get their legs taken out from under them, and a Jimmy Butler situation happens or a Jason Tatum situation happens. But Ja Morant, this has happened before, and unfortunately with a guy that size, with that kind of bounce, you're going to leave yourself vulnerable to these really dangerous plays. And it wasn't a dirty play from Lou Dort. And I don't know how many, I wasn't following it on X, but I don't know how many people were talking about it as a dirty play. It is, I can understand the notion that Lou Dort, like Draymond, like Marcus Smart, like Dylan Brooks, they always seem to find themselves in these kind of situations. But that's because Lou Dort busted his ass down the floor to stop the play. And like, I can't knock a dude who is playing his ass off trying to defend what most players would be like, you know what? I'm just going to let Scottie Pippen get that layup. Lou Dort made an incredible closeout there to at least have Scottie Pippen here in the footsteps. And unfortunately, Ja Morant had to leave the game. It was an ugly play. I mean, Chet Holmgren was out for the majority of this season with that fractured hip. I hope that we see more Ja Morant coming forward and playing in this game, in the series. But this is the problem when we have a game that wants these guys to make acrobatic plays. This is the unfortunate cost of that.
Yes, I think that's spot on, Tom. And I think that play by Dort is also, look, Ja gets hurt. That's what sparks OKC to have a great comeback and eventually win that game by 6 points. But that effort by Dort is also why Oklahoma City had that massive comeback, down 29 100%. Points in the first half. Because even down 27 in that moment, he still was motoring his way up the floor to stop a fast break. And that mindset carried OKC through the entire second half. An amazing comeback. Alex Caruso with some of the best defensive plays I've seen any guy make all season long. Dude, but a lot of time you say, like, oh, it looks like varsity versus JV. That was like varsity versus Pee Wee. It was just crazy. Some of the plays Caruso was making with quick hands. Oh, my.
I'm going to start wearing beautiful. A headband on this. Yeah, if he does this again, I mean, we're going to see Alex Caruso on this podcast, just me trying to channel some of that energy out there. Yeah, look at that. I got to grow a little bit of a scruff. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's awesome, dude. And like, what a trade. What a trade. Josh Giddey had an incredible finish to the season, right, this year. But in that Dallas Mavericks series last year, he was played off the floor. He had the worst plus minus on the Oklahoma City Thunder and came to a point where they're like, we got to get rid of this guy. And who do they call up? The Chicago Bulls are like, yeah, let me give you like the best perimeter defender in the NBA in Alex Caruso. And he completely turned that game around. He has 7 steals and 17 deflections, Kev, in this series. Leads the NBA in deflections. Do you know, Kev, how many deflections that Josh Giddey had in the entire postseason last year in 10 games? It was 7. 7 deflections wow. in 10 games. And and what Alex Caruso has done, 17 in 3 games. Wow. He had 7 steals in 3 games, and Josh Giddey had 2 steals in 10 games last postseason. Sam Presti, well, way to go. That heist, that at the time I said that was the trade of the offseason, and it is that fact, plus 53 in this series so far. Alex Caruso, awesome.
Well, that's why you go out and get him with what you saw in that game too. And like, look, he was doing it against everybody. He did it against Pippen, did it against Jackson. Like, it didn't matter player size, skill, shape, whatever. He was dominance. I felt like even without Ja Morant, Memphis should have won that game. Jaren Jackson, 22 points on 7 of 16. Desmond Bane, 10 points on 3 of 14. Pippen's second half was not the same as his first half. your second, third, fourth, fifth best players can't be that bad to blow that lead at home when you're against the wall down 2-0. I thought they just completely folded. They didn't show resilience, mental toughness, holding that lead in the second half. And look, you got to give OKC credit with their defense and what they did, but like OKC's up 3-0 and SGA has not been great through three games. He's averaging 24 points, only 35% from the field, shooting below 30% from three. You're up 3-0 and the potential NBA MVP has not been that great. Just kind of crazy, man. I felt like Memphis's other guys really let me down in that game three. I still felt like they should have won. But Jaren Jackson and Desmond Bain specifically were not able to elevate their play in ways that they should have without Ja out there. Yeah, I was just really disappointed, Tom. I thought they could get more out of them in that second half.
Yeah, they just ran out of fumes. And this is the thing about the Thunder is like they play so hard all of the time and they have got so many bodies that they just throw at you. And they look like, you know, like in the cartoons when like a wolf pack like sees like a slab, a steak of red meat, and they just go at it. That's what the Thunder looked like in that second half with Lu Dort, with Kaysen Wallace, with Alex Caruso. So many bodies that just hound you. And they, Ja Morant injury, like they're, Ja Morant getting injured is not going to make Chet Holmgren hit all those threes and dominate in the second half like he did. But you can
Chet
see
was
how
unbelievable.
Unreal, dude.
Unbelievable.
Unreal. He was so good. And look, Ja Morant's not going to stop those shots from going in. But you can see how the Thunder saw the blood in the water and they just completely destroyed the Memphis Grizzlies' spirit in that second half. And I just want to say, Kev, I don't know where you are on the whole like two big lineup with Chet and Isaiah Hartenstein, but I'm going to give you some numbers here. It with Chet at the five, and when OKC was making that run in the second half, a lot of it was a Chet at the five. In 23 minutes, the score was 60-38 when Chet was without Isaiah Hartenstein playing at the five, when it was just Chet at the five, plus 22 in 23 minutes. And with both of those guys on the floor in just 9 minutes, like Degnault pulled the plug pretty early on in both halves with the two big lineup. They were minus four in 9 minutes with the two big lineup. And with Chet on the floor without Hartenstein, it was like it was a different ball game. And I wonder if we're going to see more of that going forward. Is we've seen Degnault try this two big lineup at the end of the season to get some reps, to get some sample size, to see how they play. But what we've seen so far in this series is they are at their apex. They are at their best when it's Chet at the five or Hartenstein at the five.
I think that's 100% true, Tom. And look, this is why he experimented with it. Get that lineup reps, and you can still revert to one big lineups when necessary. And this speaks to what OKC, what makes them so special, why they're a 68-win team. Obviously, they have high-end talent, but the amount of lineup versatility Degnault has. Like if he has a series later in the playoffs, or even next round against the Clippers, where you need to go with two bigs, or against the Nuggets, not going to dismiss them. Next round, like you can go with two bigs. You could space out with five. You can play with more of a bruiser and Hartenstein. They have so much versatility that these other teams don't have in the front court. Boston has that with Horford and Porzingis, but not a lot of teams have the two big option. But ultimately, as you said, the one big is what's working a lot better right now for Oklahoma City in that series. That series will have their game four this weekend. I'm expecting it to be a sweep. I don't feel good about it for Memphis. And last thing on this series, Tom, I said after game one, that blowout by OKC, I think I said it on the pod. I know I posted it on social as well. This, I would rather have not made the playoffs if I were the Grizzlies, because they lost their first round pick by making the postseason. They had a top 14 protected pick in what will be a pretty good draft in the lottery with a lot of talent deep into the lotto, deep into the middle of first round. They lose that pick to the Wizards because they made the playoffs. Now, in no way am I implying that, oh, they should have tanked. They couldn't tank. The players are trying. The players are competing. They have belief in themselves. I'm just saying from a fan perspective and from a front office and ownership perspective, I'd rather have not made the playoffs because of the pick. The other reason is because of the risk of injury. And so you lose your pick. You get this demoralizing series with a blown 29-point lead. You get absolutely demolished in game one. And Ja Morant suffers an injury, and we don't know the severity or how long it will last. But, like, this is worst-case scenario here, Tom. It really is for Memphis. This is a worst-case scenario series. What could actually be learned? What playoff scars have been gained? What new lessons have been learned for the Memphis Grizzlies as part of this series? How is this experience going to help Zach Edey? I just don't see the silver linings for Memphis here. And I mean, look, like I said, there's no tanking out of the play-in, but I wish for that franchise they had lost that play-in and had been able to keep their first round pick and avoided all of this mess, getting slaughtered by OKC and their star player getting hurt. It just sucks.
Yeah. And this is kind of what Mark Cuban and the Mavs did when they shut down Kyrie and Luka a couple of years ago, and they got Derek Lively out of it. And maybe Zach Kleiman, by firing Taylor Jenkins, was trying to tank the rest of the season. I don't think he was, but like, there's a top 14 protected first round pick on the other side of that, and maybe that factored into it. I don't think that that's the case, but you can see why that would be a motivating factor to make sure that you don't embarrass yourself in the postseason. And you say that this is the right decision to fire Taylor Jenkins, to fire Michael Malone. Well, in both of those instances, the two teams are getting embarrassed so far in the postseason. So if the goal was to kind of give yourself a reason to hit the reset button, both of those instances are proving to be true. And so both Denver and Memphis right now, I think, are on the precipice of saying, of having real face in the mirror, looking at yourself and saying, who are we going forward? And with Ja Morant now dealing with this hip injury on top of all of the injuries that he had this season, where he's missing 30 plus games, and this has become part of what is par for the course with Ja Morant, this is going to be a real soul searching offseason for the Memphis Grizzlies.
Let's move back to the Eastern Conference. On Friday night, the Celtics and Magic will play their game three. Boston is up 2-0 in this series. Some injuries in this one. Jrue Holiday's questionable with a hamstring strain. And Jason Tatum, he's got a severe wrist injury and doubtful for game three as well. How concerned are you for Boston's finals hopes when it comes to this Tatum injury, Tom?
I thought that was the best playoff game I've ever seen Jaylen Brown play. Best one I've ever seen play. That was incredible. Like, the Jaylen Brown that we saw in game two was outrageous. The step backs, the drives to the rim, the flushes at the rim. This guy was in full command, and I had huge concerns about that knee, and he completely washed him away. And so if we get that guy going forward and letting Jason Tatum need a couple weeks to get back from this wrist injury, or a week to get back from this wrist injury, I have less concerns. But that Jaylen Brown performance was awesome. I mean, the 36, 10, and 5 on elite shooting percentages. This dude was full 94 feet, getting rebounds and going down the other end of the floor. He had no issues. I was worried about that knee and the fact that he missed the last few games of the regular season, and having a big spot like this, taking that load, the minutes, the scoring, the responsibility on both ends of the floor. Jaylen Brown looked awesome. His game score in that game, meaning his player efficiency rate, his productivity in that game, was the best of his entire postseason career. And we're talking about a guy who just won finals MVP. Jaylen Brown was so good in that game. I'm worried about this injury and how it impacts the Celtics' chances going forward. But I was more worried before game two because I did not know how Jaylen Brown was going to respond and how that knee was going to respond. But dude, he was unreal in that game.
I mean, look, the Celtics just won the finals with Tatum doing everything but scoring. So, I mean, like, yes, there's a level of concern, but I think you nailed it, Tom. Jaylen Brown, like, it's kind of ironic. The concern heading into the postseason was his health with his knee issue, and he had one of his best postseason games that he's ever had. So I'm cautiously concerned for Boston, you know, with what a Eastern Conference Finals might look like if Tatum is limited at all, if he's not scoring. the way he needs to. I'm less worried for a second round matchup against the Knicks or the Pistons. But like they need Tatum to be better than he was last year in the finals as a scorer and as a 3-point shooter. If it's OKC or even if it's the Clippers, whoever it might be coming out of the West, or even against the Cavaliers in the Eastern Conference Finals. But ultimately, again, in this series against the Magic, it's not a concern at all. I am curious on the Orlando side of things, Tom. What have your impressions been so far of Paolo Banchero and Franz Wagner? Because with Banchero, I like a lot of what I've seen with him. With Franz Wagner, on the other hand, everything's been good except still for the shooting. Everything except for the shooting. He's 1 of 6 from 3 in game 1, 1 of 7 from 3 in game 2. The dude, I said the stat earlier in the week, like he's the third guy in NBA history that had a year where he took over 5 threes per game, shot below 30%, and shot over 80% from the free throw line. He's a high-touch guy inside the arc, but then from threes, just the jumper looks ugly. He's developed a hitch. And for Orlando, Banchero is checking some boxes in this series. Franz Wagner, this missing piece is critical for his future next to Paolo, or else I think we're going to end up having some of those Brown-Tatum-style debates. Can those guys coexist? That we'll be having Bradley that in Orlando. Right. We'll be having that with Banchero and Wagner, whereas Banchero is answering a lot of questions. Franz needs to be able to shoot, and like that's not going to happen this series. It's going to have to be something that happens over the summer.
He looks terrified to shoot from distance, and I get it why. Like, when you're talking about a guy who was 29% on high volume threes in the regular season, 26% since March 1st, and then coming into this series against the Boston Celtics, that are one of the highest volume 3-point shooting team in the NBA, and you're still terrified to shoot. And I think Orlando has done a pretty good job defensively against Boston. Like, Boston is one of the best offenses we've seen in a long time, and they've been able to keep them well below their averages and well below their normal output. But it's just the offense. They need someone to crack the offense, penetrate, and shoot from distance. They need 3-point shooting. And someone, like if Trae Young, if we knew that he was a good 3-point shooter and we could get a 37, 38% 3-point field goal percentage, if we could get that guy, it would do wonders for this Orlando team because they need it in the worst way. And Franz Wagner was supposed to be that guy, the ball dominant creator from the perimeter who could pull up in pick and rolls and hit that shot. He's lost that. And we need a whole offseason to kind of regain that confidence and figure out what's going on there. Because like you said, this guy has looked like he was in the running to be an all-star this season. Like, he was on the track to be an all-star this season. And then everything fell apart perimeter-wise, and we haven't seen the same guy.
I had, like, in December, I had Franz third team All-NBA. It's only like a month and a half into the season, but he was unbelievable to start the year. Banchero, been great this series. They need more from Franz as a shooter as well. And, like, not to take anything away from Franz, he's doing everything else. It's just the shooting is not there for him yet. And Banchero's looked good. Let's talk about the final series that we haven't touched on yet, the Cavs and the Heat. Cleveland moved up 2-0 in this series after beating the Heat, which was a closer game than anticipated. Donovan Mitchell had to hit some big shots down the stretch. That game 3 is on Saturday. And what shocked me, Tom, was after the game, Darius Garland gets asked, what's the key against Miami? And he says, pick on their key defenders. Pick on Tyler Hero. Just straight up called out Tyler Hero. Like, he's being honest, but you're giving bulletin board material to the Heat, which you're a little bit less worried about. But B, you're the guy teams are going to be picking on. They're going to be picking on you later in the playoffs when you're facing a team that actually has a shot at winning at all. They're going to pick on you. That's the game plan.
Oh, my God.
You're just shocked by him saying that. Like, that clip is going to pop up again later in the playoffs when it's like Boston, Cleveland, and Tatum and Brown are bringing Garland into every action. It's going to happen.
100%. We're going to see that meme, like him saying that right there, pick on Tyler Hero and just cross out Tyler Hero and put Darius Garland. That is going to be the meme going forward. There's going to be some bad Cavs losses, whether it's in this series. I don't think it's going to be this series, but Miami almost pulled it out there in game two. I do think that that is a bulletin board material, not for the Heat. Like, I get it. The Heat will use that. I'm not too worried about it from their perspective, especially if Bam Adebayo just looks like Draymond Green's offensive repertoire 2.0. Like, Bam Adebayo's got to be better. We can't have Bam Adebayo scoring this little in these two, not making an impact with the ball. We need more out of him, but he's also, you know, he's a guy that is playing against a really good Cleveland Cavaliers team that I love the bravado from Darius Garland. Part of me says I like that he's got this, like, this kind of boldness to it, that he's willing to say that about Tyler Hero. But you can expect it from, like, Donovan Mitchell or a veteran who has gone deep in the postseason or what have you. To have Darius Garland say this, where he is going to be targeted relentlessly in one of these series, oh man, that is a great call by you, Kev. That's an incredible call out for Darius Garland to do that, man. That is not, in my opinion, not a smart move.
No, I don't think it was a smart move either. Granted, you know, like, it's just a little trash talk. You know, it's not going to change a whole lot. I just know for him, he's going to have to deal with that clip being out there and all the drama that comes from that. And Evan Mobley, who wins Defensive Player of the Year, congratulations to him for winning that award. He's going to have to be the guy that shows why he was named the Defensive Player of the Year at some point in this postseason when they are picking on the smallest guy on the floor. That's going to have to be the thing for Cleveland. Are you surprised Mobley won it, Tom?
I was. I thought Draymond was going to win it. That's what I said to Yahoo Sports when we were asked who was our prediction that was going to win. I certainly didn't believe, and we talked about it, I didn't believe Draymond Green deserved the award. Honestly, it was Victor's award. It was Victor's award, and I was surprised that Evan Mobley beat out Draymond considering the campaign. But given the... there weren't great choices this year. Like, we both said Amen Thompson were our Defensive Player of the Years, respectively, but I didn't feel great about Evan Mobley's candidacy. I didn't feel great about Draymond's. Felt a little bit better for Thompson, and that's why I think he checked more boxes laterally. Like, all the things you want out of a defender, he did a lot more for his team than I think Evan Mobley and Draymond did. He's a deserving candidate, but I feel like this is kind of like Marcus Smart winning a few years ago, where it's like, there weren't a lot of great candidates aside from Victor Wembanyama. And unfortunately, with the blood clot and then the new rule of you have to play 65 games in order to be eligible, I think we're going to look back on this one and be like, yeah, we should have just given it to Wemby. I know it's where he's disqualified, but I just feel like this was his year.
Should have given it to Amen Thompson. Not that I'm biased at all. I didn't vote for him. I did vote for him. Yeah, I had Amen Thompson first in my ballot. I was one of nine to vote for him. I'm a little surprised Amen didn't get more love. I am surprised Dyson Daniels, 25 first place votes for a bottom 10 defense in Atlanta. I mean, I think team results have to matter a bit here when it comes to Defensive Player of the Year. I was shocked by that, Tom. But Evan Mobley ended up winning the award. You know, Dyson Daniels came in second place ahead of Draymond Green. That's the part that shocked me most out of that. We'll have more awards coming out, more playoff series to talk about. Tom, thanks for joining me today, man.
Hey, thanks for having me. Always on these Fridays. I love doing this show. Have a great weekend, man, and enjoy the hoops this weekend.
You can check out Tom's show, The Big Number, everywhere you get your podcast. Please subscribe to this one everywhere you get your podcast as well. Thanks to Mike and Emmy for producing us, and thanks to you for giving us a listen. We'll be back on Tuesday with an episode talking about the NBA playoffs. See you.